Karl Rove, you know, I go back with you to 82.
The Bill Clements campaign.
Yeah, 82. The one I lost.
We all lost it.
Yeah. But you guys came back in 86 and won.
Yeah.
I wasn't there in 86. Yeah, yeah. I was just there for a kind of cameo appearance.
Yeah.
But Karl, you know, we've talked time, you know, I have great respect for what you're doing. And I put money with you. And
thank you.
And
thank
all.
You.
And, but what do we got now? This has got to be the strangest bird. I'm not talking about person. I'm just talking about it's a strange animal that we have in this campaign.
Yeah. We've never had as many candidates seeking the Republican nomination in our history going back to 1856. Never had so many qualified candidates.
No way I remember it. It was kind of, they were picked before the thing started.
Yeah, back then they'd show up at the convention, and through 1896 they would show up at the convention. So there'd be a front runner, a couple of other people. Nobody'd have a majority of the delegates. The boys would get in the back room, smoke a few cigars, drink a little bit of whiskey, and arrive at an agreement. But it would generally take multiple ballots to get there. Between 1856 and 1896, the first 50 years of the Republican Party, the only conventions that have one ballot.
You said 1856 to
1896. 1896, the first 40 years of the party.
Okay, 1896 to...
Well, 1856, the founding of the Republican Party, to 1896, the election of William McKinley. The only one-ballot conventions are the conventions that renominate someone. If you're nominating an open race, like in 1880, it took 36 ballots to nominate James A. Garfield. And that multiple ballot convention was broken in 1896 by the first modern presidential primary campaign mounted by William McKinley.
But
and he walked into the convention.
McKinley's the one that you wrote the book about. Great book.
Yeah, well, thanks. Thanks.
Okay, then, I mean, here we are. We got more candidates than we've ever had.
Yeah.
And they don't, any of them go away.
Yeah. Now, well, they'll start to go away because what's going to happen is there'll be a process of winnowing. There's only so many times you can come in 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th.
Well, you run out of money.
You run out of money. We'll have a couple that'll dry up after Iowa, and we'll probably have a couple more that'll dry up after New Hampshire, and maybe one or two more after South Carolina. My sense is this race has great potential to get down to two or three candidates by March 15th, which is when we start voting winner-take-all states. And if on that day, March 15th, somebody wins Florida and Ohio, the two biggest blocks of delegates up that day, in all likelihood, they're the nominee.
Okay, now, the only subject, you know, I'm fluent on is energy. And is energy going to be a factor in this, or could it be?
Oh, I hope it is, because what I think it is an opportunity for the Republican candidate to strike a couple of notes. One, a note of optimism about the country, because they can point to the success of America in becoming energy independent. The government didn't do it. Foreign countries didn't do it for us. It was American know-how, American ingenuity that has brought on the fracking revolution and is making us energy independent. And so we can herald that, and what we can do is the right candidate, if they're smart, will stand up and say, we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to revitalize our manufacturing base. As you said, cheap domestic energy,
unbelievable.
Trump's cheap foreign labor. And so we got an opportunity for somebody to stand up and go to places like, look, I've been in Northeast Ohio, Timken ball bearings. You talk to those guys at Timken, and they're competing with, you know, they export to China because the Chinese can't copy their work, and because of cheap domestic energy just to power our manufacturing.
And Ohio's got it.
And well, and they've had coal, and now they got natural gas. And so now they're able with assurance to say, look, we got a clean energy source here coming online, so let's build more of our plants in the U.S. And anyway, a Republican candidate can stand up and say, we got a shot to reinvigorate our domestic manufacturing basis, but we also have a chance to stop spending money in a part of the world where they dress funny and don't like us. And they can also say, by God, we can start having people dependent upon us. Just like people have been worried for decades about what's going on in the Persian Gulf, they will start currying favor with us because we can supply the energy they need.
Okay, here you are. There's no way that oil can compete with natural gas as far as clean.
Mm-hmm.
It won't work.
Right.
It's not possible. the Volkswagen people, they came up with a way to do it.
Yeah, it was called messing around with their software, so it gave up phony results on their diesel cars.
That's right. Yeah. And so that really has hurt diesel.
Yeah.
And Cummins is so advanced on how...
The manufacturer of the truck engines.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I mean, they are way out front.
Yeah.
And those guys have, they've got an engine, a 9-liter, 12-liter coming up, but has 90% less NOx emissions. Yeah. It's unheard of.
Yeah.
It's cleaner than the grid.
Yeah.
Okay. All of that is going to come to the surface, and a lot of things are going to change in energy, I'd say, within the next 5 years. But you think it could be an issue.
A smart person would make it an issue. I mean, you know, look, the economy, there are going to be two big issues driving the election, national security and the economy. The economy almost always is the most important issue. National security, because of ISIS and because of, you know, the incidents around the world, is going to be an important issue. But the economy is a driver of it. And a smart candidate is going to say, this is a way for us to get better jobs.
Sure. You got exactly. Yeah. You're going to move jobs back this way.
Yeah. It's already happening. Think about how long we went without new refineries. And now people are talking about expanding existing facilities or even building new ones.
Well, okay. We're in agreement on that. But, you know, we've been around a long time. We're usually in agreement on most things.
Yeah, I'm smart enough to know that.
You're smarter than I am, is what you said.
No.
I catch on. I touched on your book.
Yeah.
Yeah. How are sales going?
Mr. Simon and Mr. Schuster seem to be very happy with them, so I'm happy.
You're getting rich again.
Actually, I'm earning back my advance. See, they have to pay me in advance, and then I have to earn it back for them. So
I know a little bit about that. You know, I had a couple of books. People seldom get rich off books.
Yeah, no, they don't. They don't. But I had a lot of fun. It was
You have a chance to show your intellectual, how smart you are.
No, my passion for history.
And you are. Yeah, you are a historian.
Yeah,
you truly are.
You know what, though? It's got an Oklahoma connection. One of the guys who I wrote about, William McKinley, in the election of 1896, and how history gets him wrong and how history gets the election wrong. And the guy who is the modern American historian who stood up and said exactly that after nearly 100 years of misinterpreting McKinley was a professor at the University of Oklahoma, H. Wayne Morgan. And he
was a well-known guy.
He was a well-known guy, and he died 2 years ago. But before, I was writing my book, and I called him up out of the blue, and he couldn't have been more helpful. And for about a year, I'd send him things. He'd give me advice and counsel, and I dedicated the book to him and three other historians who've helped revitalize McKinley's reputation. But, I mean, McKinley, nobody knows him. I mean, we honor JFK for PT-109. We honor H.W. Bush for enlisting in the Navy at the age of 18, becoming a fighter pilot.
No.
A bomber pilot.
That's right.
A bomber pilot.
Yeah. He was, what was that plane called? Anyway, it was a bomber. Well, it was a torpedo.
Torpedo bomber. But McKinley enlists in the military at the age of 18 as a private in the 23rd Ohio and fights through the entire Civil War and emerges as a major, having received three battlefield commissions for unbelievable valor. He is recommended for the Congressional Medal of Honor, and he discourages his comrades from pressing the application, saying, "I only did my duty." And he's a remarkable man who runs the first modern presidential primary, the first modern presidential election, is the first candidate of either party in the primary season nomination battle to openly ask for the support of blacks. He goes to a church in Savannah, Georgia, and a meeting with black leaders in Jacksonville, Florida, in March of 1895, and no candidate for president has ever done that.
Well, he was a leader, no question, but he hasn't been recognized as a leader until you wrote the book. But when he was assassinated was when? 1896?
No, September 1901. He serves a very successful first term. The economy, which had been in deep depression, suddenly bursts into prosperity. He annexes Hawaii. He fights a short popular war with Spain, and we end up with Puerto Rico, a free Cuba, and the Philippines. He helps bring about the first efforts to rein in uncompetitive practices of the business trust. But when he dies, and he's reelected in 1900. Picks a young running mate, 40-year-old. New Yorker named Theodore Roosevelt, governor of New York.
Okay, now, you know where Roosevelt was when McKinley was assassinated?
He was hunting McKinley is shot. Everybody believes that he's on the mend. Theodore Roosevelt goes hunting in the Adirondacks. He is literally miles away from any transportation. And a telegram is sent that the president is fading, and he literally rides a horse in the middle of the night to catch a train in the Adirondacks and arrive shortly after.
Where was it he caught the train?
I used to know, like Tyndall, New York or something.
I've been there. Glen Echo or Glen Lake,
yeah.
It's Glen Lake, I think. Yeah, yeah. I've been there. And there is a plaque there at the train station saying this is where Roosevelt boarded the train to go to Washington.
Well, McKinley is enormously popular at his death. In fact, we don't know how popular he was. I mean, just enormous outpouring of grief. He's killed by a terrorist, an anarchist, kills him, and admits
ISIS?
ISIS. These are an international group of anarchists that attempted to kill the Tsar of Russia. They killed the Empress of Austria-Hungary. They'd attempted to kill, in some instances, killed the President of France, the Prime Minister of Spain, Prime Minister of Italy. They even made an assassination attempt on the Pope, that a guy with a knife in the Papal Gardens. But when they kill McKinley, the nation, it grieves enormously. 500,000 people line the railroad tracks between Buffalo and Washington.
It was like Reagan.
Yeah,
when he died.
Yeah. When the train comes plowing into, burying his body, comes plowing into Harrisburg, Pennsylvania to take on water, 30,000 people have jammed the railroad station. So many people that the governor of Pennsylvania cannot force his way through the crowd to pay his respects to Mrs. McKinley. And when the train pulls out of the station, they all begin spontaneously singing God Bless America. The tracks leading into the Baltimore station have been lined for several hundred yards with huge mounds of flowers that the citizens of Baltimore have come and thrown on the tracks, and the train comes plowing into the station covered with rose petals and flower petals. Dawn falls when the train pulls out of Baltimore, and a reporter who's riding on the train is deeply moved by the vision between Baltimore and Washington. Every 100 yards or so is a bonfire lit in a farmer's field, and standing at the farm families, many of them poor blacks, with their hands over their hearts, hats off their head as their fallen chief comes by. He's finally buried 2 days later in Canton, Ohio, in a receiving vault. They haven't had time to prepare a sarcophagus for him. 16,000 people march into the cemetery, led by the military and veterans. And the school children of Nashville, Tennessee.
Veterans would be veterans of the Civil War.
He's the last Civil War president. And the school children of Nashville, Tennessee have sent sweet pea flowers, trainloads of sweet pea flowers that have been strewn on the path. And you have this image of grizzled Civil War veterans reaching down, plucking the flowers, putting them in their lapels. The entire cabinet is there, many of them openly weeping. Roosevelt, the new president, is standing apart from
him. How old is he?
He's 40 years old.
So he's younger than some of these guys running now.
Yeah, and he's standing there apart from his cabinet because he's so overcome with emotion that he thinks that if he sits with them, he won't be able to control himself. I've been to this site. Behind the site of the receiving vault, which is still there, is a ridge that runs about 500 yards, about 50 feet tall. And I have pictures of it.
A ridge line
right behind in the cemetery.
It was a rock ridge.
Well, it's soil.
It's not
man-made, naturally occurring ridgeline, and it was grassy. And on the ridgeline, the entire ridgeline is lined with floral tributes. Now, some of them are from like the Tsar of Russia and the President of Argentina, but most of them are gigantic floral tributes from working people. You know, there's an enormous wreath from the tin men of East Liverpool, Ohio, and then there'll be from the miners of Lackawanna County, Pennsylvania, and from the men of the Homestead Iron Smelter, number one. All these working people.
I mean, it got everybody.
Got everybody, and he was thought of as a president who'd return the country to prosperity, and an outpouring of grief for the guy. And today, largely forgotten, in part because the historians who came along in the 1920s and 30s, who were writing about that era, saw more in William Jennings Bryan than they saw in McKinley. They liked William Jennings Bryan's ideology. They were progressive historians. They liked what he had to say more than they liked what McKinley had to say. So they downplayed McKinley, made him appear like he's the tool of his campaign manager, Marcus Alonzo Hanna, and played up
it
the guy
who
lost.
It hasn't changed that much, has it?
Well, it has. The politics back then look a lot like today. I mean, the political system before McKinley is broken. We have 5 presidential elections in a row in which nobody gets 50% of the vote. 2 presidents during that time are elected with a majority in the Electoral College, but they lose the popular vote. Another candidate wins the Electoral College and has a plurality victory over his Democrat opponent, 7,000 votes nationwide. And there's divided government. 20 out of the 24 years, there's a president of one party, and Congress is held by at least one, or both houses are held by the other party. And they don't get anything done. And along comes McKinley.
They don't get anything done.
They don't get anything done.
There's a similarity.
Well, in fact, it's worse. It makes today look like kumbaya. 1890, Republicans take the House. They're sworn in 1891. They begin to meet, and the Democrats say, we will use a parliamentary trick and deny the ability of the Congress to take up a single bill. And they do so by refusing to answer the roll call, denying the House a quorum. They'll be
so
there on the floor.
They can't get a quorum.
So after a couple of days, Thomas Brackett Reed is the speaker, about 6'3" tall, 300 pounds.
Well, he starts whipping guys.
No, what he does is he simply says to the clerk at the end of the roll call, he says the chair directs the clerk to show Mr. Jones present, Mr. Smith present, Mr. Martin present, Mr. Fall present. And a Democrat stands up and says, under God and the Constitution, you have no right to count me present on the floor. And Reed says, the chair is merely stating the fact. Does the honorable gentleman from Kentucky deny he's present on the floor of the House? This kicks off a 3-month-long battle to figure out whether or not he has the parliamentary right to do this. On one of the first days of the debate.
But I bet he won.
He won, but it took him 3 months to win. And it was acrimonious. In one of the first days of the debate, Congressman William Henry Howdy Martin of Texas stands up and points to him and says, will any member order me to remove this dictator from his position upon the podium? And I will do so by force forthwith. And
how big was he?
6'6" tall, thin as a rail, mean as a snake, fought through the entire Civil War with Hood's Brigade. And Reed, very cool customer, says, the honorable gentleman from Texas is out of order. Martin was so irritated that he started showing up every day thereafter, taking a seat right in front of Reed at the podium, pulling out his 16-inch long Bowie knife and methodically sharpening it on his boot heel in an attempt to menace Reed during the debates. Didn't work. He lost.
Oh, Carl, you have way too much information.
Yeah, way too much.
You're good. Okay, thanks for being on my podcast.
There we go. What the heck is a podcast, bro?
I don't know for sure. I'm going to find out, though.